You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, Israel's former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is sentenced to 6 years in prison for bribery. A remarkable fall from grace for one of the country's most prominent politicians.
People are still trying to make sense of it. What does it say about corruption? Does it mean that we have the ability to press charges and to actually reach a better level of politics? Or does it mean that everyone is corrupt?
Raffaello Pantucci and Jeffrey Kaufman will be here to discuss that and the rest of the day's news. Also ahead, France's justice minister faces calls to quit after refusing to sing the national anthem at a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the abolition of slavery. We'll assess when it's okay to keep quiet during a national anthem. All that, plus we'll hear why Colombia's World Cup dreams at this year's tournament in Brazil have taken a dent thanks to an injury to one of its star players.
The big question is Falcao going to be ready in 30 days' time to play in Brazil? And people are saying that without him, without their best striker, it's going to be difficult to get those goals.
All that, plus music and a novelist and more, here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before any of that, here is Suzanne Chislett with the latest news headlines for around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Suzanne Chislett. 20 miners have died and more than 200 are trapped after an explosion in a coal mine in western Turkey. Local officials say the blast in Manisa was caused by an electrical fault. 20 people are thought to have been rescued from the mine. The explosion happened during a shift change around 2 kilometres below ground. The Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk has urged Russia not to use natural gas as a new type of weapon against his country. Speaking alongside the European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, he also accused Moscow of seizing tens of billions of dollars worth of its assets and energy resources in Crimea. The Russian energy giant Gazprom earlier demanded a $1.66 billion prepayment from Kiev for June gas deliveries, saying Ukraine had only half its requirements in storage to ensure a trouble-free winter.
We are ready for the market-based approach. And Russia is to stop to use natural gas as another or a new type of Russian weapon, except a nuclear one. If Russia rejects this, we will bring Russia to court in Stockholm. If I am not mistaken, less than 20 days left.
Nigeria's government says a window of negotiation is open with Boko Haram rebels who abducted more than 200 girls a month ago. A special committee has been set up to consider any demands. American surveillance aircraft have been flying over the remote areas in the northeast, where it's thought the students are being held. A top European court has ruled that internet companies can be made to remove irrelevant or excessive personal information from search engine results. The Court of Justice of the European Union upheld a complaint from a Spanish man over his right to be forgotten. He'd objected that Google searches on his name threw up links to a 1998 newspaper article about the repossession of his home. Google says it's disappointed with the ruling. In the US, two health workers at a hospital in Orlando, Florida, who were exposed to a patient with Middle East respiratory syndrome, have begun showing flu-like symptoms. Doctors say one of the two has been hospitalized. They were treating someone who's believed to have flown into the country with the virus. The World Health Organization's holding a conference in Geneva today to determine whether the spread of MERS, which was first detected in Saudi Arabia, merits it declaring an international emergency. Jordan's ambassador to Libya has arrived back home a month after he was kidnapped by gunmen. Fawaz Al-Itan says his release came after Jordan decided to release a Libyan Islamist militant who'd been serving a life sentence for a bombing plot. It's led to some Jordanian officials voicing concern at the precedent the handover could set for Amman. It's a key ally with the US in the fight against Al-Qaeda. Paris and London continue to vie for the title of the world's top tourist destination. Official figures just released show 16.6 million people visited the home of the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre and Notre Dame last year, while 16.8 million toured the British capital. Nicolas Lefebvre, Director General of the Paris Tourist Office, says it's a healthy competition.
Most of international visitors coming from far regions of the world, from Asia, from Middle East, from Americas. Very often they go in both cities, in London and Paris. So we have same visitors and we are very happy to be such close with London. London is of course a great city for tourism, different from Paris, so we are more complementary cities than competitive cities.
An American underwater investigator believes he's found the wreck of the Santa Maria, the flagship of Christopher Columbus's 1492 expedition to the New World. Mary Clifford says evidence strongly suggests a ruin off Haiti's north coast is that of the ship. It was lost shortly before the explorer returned to Spain. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne Chislett, thank you very much indeed. It is 18.06 here in London. It's 13.06 in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's Midori House. It's Tuesday. Thank you very much for joining us today. In the studio, I have Raffaello Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London and Geoffrey Kaufman of ABC News. Geoffrey, Raffaello, thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to begin in Israel, where the country's former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was jailed today for 6 years for his part in a bribery scandal that has brought about a remarkable fall from grace for one of Israel's most prominent political figures. Mr. Olmert and six co-defendants were found guilty of accepting millions of dollars in bribes from the Holy Land Development Corporation as it redeveloped parts of Jerusalem in the years before Mr. Olmert became Prime Minister. A short while ago, the journalist Noam Shezaf gave us his reaction to the news from Tel Aviv.
I think that people expected between 2 and 4 years. 6 years is a bit harsh, but there's still the appeal to the Supreme Court, so he might get a lighter punishment. This is the first prime minister that will be sent to prison if the Supreme Court doesn't cancel the sentence or the conviction itself. And it is definitely the big story of the day, of the week. And right now, I think people are still trying to make sense of it. What does it say about corruption? Does it mean that we have the ability to press charges and to actually reach a better level of politics? Or does it mean that everyone is corrupt? Not only Olmert was sent to prison. We need to remember that his finance minister, Hirson, is already in prison. And the president, which is the symbolic head of state from this period, Moshe Katsav, is also in prison, serving on sex offences at prison term. So it does look bad.
It does look bad, yes. Noam Shezaf there. Geoffrey Kaufman, as he mentions there at the end, this isn't just Olmert, it's the finance minister previously. It's the president from that era as well is in jail. Is this just coincidence or can we read something into a sort of a wider significance within Israeli politics?
You know, just hearing that comment and reading about this, so the notion that this looks bad, I take issue with. I actually think this looks good because this is the way democracy and the courts are meant to work. How many countries, you know, Israel is, there are a lot of things you can criticize Israel for, but how many countries in the world, let alone in the Middle East, would actually do this, put one of their most powerful people behind bars for bribery? I think it's fascinating. You know, this, I think there are a lot of European countries that would have trouble. Look at Silvio Berlusconi. Look at the trouble they've had prosecuting him.
Or look at France, Raffaello Pantucci. I mean, it's, as Geoffrey says, it's, you know, you could look at a number of countries and, you know, Let's look at just pure allegations, whether it's in Germany with Helmut Kohl, whether it's in France with Jacques Chirac, Nicolas Sarkozy. There have been numerous occasions where powerful people across Europe have been accused of things, but haven't actually ever faced any sort of justice, Raffaello.
Well, I mean, I think that there is something to this. And it's certainly true that, for example, in Italy, Silvio Berlusconi just got finally convicted for his role in one of the many scandals he's sort of been implicated in. And he got, I think it was community service in an old people's home. And the whole conversation really was about the fact that it was kind of amusing, the fact that he was basically older than some of the people in the old people's home who he was meant to help. But that's the sort of punishment which has come after decades of sort of wrangling in the courts. That's the one side of the equation. The other side of the equation is, however, you know, there's that old maxim that I'm completely forgetting right now, but, you know, okay, one leader falls foul of, you know, authorities in the way. As your commentator just pointed out there in the piece, this is, I think, the sixth Israeli prime minister to fall in this sort of a fashion. And so you're beginning to wonder, is this more emblematic of something symptomatic of the system and the whole process there rather than or politics in Israel in general, in which case it's actually more problematic. And so the fact that the system actually is going after people, fine, that's good. But at the same time, shouldn't we be concerned about the fact that we've had six leaders who've had to go to serve prison time because of, I know one of them was rape. I think others are allegations of bribery as well. So, you know, there is a sort of delicate balance here to be struck. And I think maybe we could argue that Israel seems to be going quite far in another direction. And maybe European countries are going too far in the other one.
Maybe Israel is just the Chicago of the Middle East. Jeffrey Kaufman, there is a slightly sadder political element to this, in that actually Ehud Olmert, once he'd stepped down from office, was one of the few Israeli political leaders that was willing to accept that actually Israel needed to make real changes if there was going to be a two-state solution.
You know, I think that the reality of covering the world for me for three decades, and I think for anyone who watches current affairs from the sidelines, is that good and bad can be in the same person. And this is a classic example of the moral stew of one complex man's personality. Obviously he did a lot of good things. He is paying the price for some huge errors in judgment, as he should. It's absolutely true. Is there something systemic in Israel that is leading politicians to do this? Or is there a sense that they can deal with impunity? Because it sure doesn't look like it anymore. Are they underpaid? Is there just a culture of abuse? Or is this just a country that's more vigorous than, say, Italy or France in prosecuting?
Raffaello, when we look at the peace process or the pathetic excuse we call the peace process, and you think of the way that Ehud Olmert was, again, not when he was actually in office, but once he'd stepped down, prepared to say, you know what, actually we need to change the way we do things. Has Israel actually lost quite an important political voice with this sentencing?
I think it's difficult to know. I mean, for me, the sort of Israeli-Palestinian peace process is one of these, depressingly, one of these certainties in international affairs, and that it will always be there. And you do get these figures who seem to rise up and do speak with a more, with a voice that seems to, you think, well, maybe there is some sort of resolution in sight, but then no resolution ever comes. I mean, we can look back at some of the other leaders. It's like Rabin, who was shot, unfortunately. You know, he was seen as a great potential peacemaker that was lost to the process. For me, it's clearly possible. It's clear that Ehud Olmert was a great leader, and I think the judge in his sentencing remarks said as much. But I think that sort of fact is one facet of the man. And in the other hand, we've seen that he's clearly a guy who was involved in bribery at an early stage in his career. And, you know, for me, his role in the peace process and sort of Israeli politics in general is one reflection. You know, I don't know, and it's a reflection on the process. It just seems to go on and on and on, and with no clear resolution in sight.
We're going to move on to a court case with a difference now. A little earlier today, one of the highest courts in Europe declared that where the internet is concerned, or more specifically Google, then all of us have the right to be forgotten. The test case against Google was brought by a Spanish man, Mario Costea Gonzalez, who claimed that a copy of the auction notice for his repossessed home, which was issued back in 1998, should no longer be visible online, given that the matter bore no relation to his life today. I'm not going to ask either of you if there are things on Google that we can find about you that you'd rather not. But Jeffrey Kaufman, this has become one of those issues that it seems like it's taken rather a long time for the courts and certainly for politicians to really catch up with the rest of the population, because all of us understand what it can be like to find something on the internet about yourself that you don't like.
You know, I don't think the internet's only really in our lives 20 something years old, and I think that it's not surprising that the law has struggled to come up with responses. I think what's interesting about this is that there is no other court of appeal for Google. They're going to have to abide by this. This is the European Union speaking, the Court of Justice. There's no appeal process. What they now face is two very different value systems in the U.S., where freedom of speech trumps privacy, and this effort to balance the two here in Europe. And so Google is going to have to put filters on. They argued, no, you know, we're just an advertising company. We just put up these links. And I don't think any of us actually believe that. Whatever your views on privacy and freedom of speech are, you know, just like we don't really believe that Amazon is based in Luxembourg here in the UK, mm-hmm. You know, these companies are having it both ways. And in Europe, where there is a stronger protection of privacy, Google's been called out. It does have huge implications. But, mm-hmm. you know, let's face it. Who doesn't have things that they'd rather not have them follow? I mean, all these kids posting their drunken pictures on Facebook at university, you know, at the age of 19, at some point, some of them are going to go somewhere and these pictures are going to follow them.
Raphael, I'm intrigued as to how this is going to work in practice, because let's say I've written something about you that you really don't like and you want me to take down. And I say, well, you know what? I think, you know, I don't have a problem with this. Is there going to be some sort of Google court where we get to fight out whether, you know, it should stay visible or not?
Well, I mean, for me, this is the European Court attacking the wrong thing. At the end of the day, they are not really targeting the content. You know, they're targeting the person who is disseminating the content further. So the content is still available. You're not actually getting rid of that. That you can't sort of eradicate from history. All you're seemingly eradicating is you're attacking this one search engine who sort of posts the links to your material in the past. I mean, I must say I haven't completely understood the technicalities of it yet. And I think part of that is probably the problem. And I'm not sure the courts totally have either. And how are they actually going to do this in practice? How does the implementation work? Are they going to, because it seems to me that this original Spanish fellow had it was something that was posted in La Vanguardia, a Spanish newspaper, and that had sort of been reposted when he was searching on Google, searching his name, it was appearing on there. But then for me, then surely it's Vanguardia who he should be going after, because they're the ultimate content provider. I'm not sure I see why Google is particularly getting the hard end of the stick.
And Geoffrey sorry, I just want to bring you in on this, Geoffrey, actually, because you talked before about the difference between the US and freedom of speech and here in Europe, but then also talks about, you know, 19-year-olds drunk on Facebook. Actually, in California, you have had this case where the governor of California has said, you know what, actually, we want Facebook and other tech companies to enable kids to be able to take stuff down after the age of 18 if they realise they've posted something that they shouldn't. So even actually in the US, the land of the free, there is an understanding in the heart of the tech boom in Palo Alto that there perhaps have to be some sorts of limits.
Yeah, you know, I think that there is a debate right now about how much transparency is good for all of us as individuals and the world. It's a very, very amusing and I think a good read. Dave Eggers' novel, The Circle, addresses this exactly. And it's really about this notion that you know, Google, that these companies don't have, it's not their problem. And, you know, we just have to live with it in this world. And it's better if we all know everything. I don't think as individuals, any one of us agree with that. The concern, of course, is will public officials be able to hide behind this ruling? There is an exemption that says people in public cannot do that. But let me be clear, Raphael. Google is the search world. It's 67% of searches on the internet are Google. You know,
they only list a small fraction of the material that's actually on the internet.
Sure, but obviously in this individual's case, and you know, I think most people in the world have something like that in their history. It just may not all yet be online, but it will be in time. You know, when Google is so dominant, and the other search engines will also have to comply, even though they're much smaller.
Yeah, and I'll ask you to name two more search engines later. I'm sure we won't be able to.
Bing and Yahoo.
Come up with some more.
Anyway, we're going to leave it there. Geoffrey Kaufman and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you both. We'll be back in a moment looking at big takeovers and national anthems.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism, at Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. My guests today, Raphael Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute and Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News. Let's turn now to the UK. Although it's a bit of an international story. The proposed takeover of the British-based AstraZeneca by the American pharmaceuticals company Pfizer. It's turning out to be one of the more contentious business deals in recent memory. And today, representatives from Pfizer were questioned by British MPs on their intentions with the company. Here's a little bit of that exchange.
Are you prepared to sustain the level of research and development budget?
It's not the percentage of sales you spend on research, it's how productive it is. So I do not expect that the combined total will remain the same. I expect it will be lower. To the extent, how much lower? At this stage, I cannot give a figure on that.
You slashed investment in R&D and you substantially cut jobs. Why on earth should we believe you?
You know, we've made a commitment to the UK. We've stated those commitments, we've published them. Before we made those commitments, we took legal counsel. Those commitments are legally binding, not just for 1 year, but for five. I understand that the takeover panel has stated that those are legally binding commitments. And let's put aside the legally binding. I'm here today to make those commitments. I intend to honor those commitments. The Pfizer board voted on those commitments. We will honor those commitments.
Well, if the Pfizer board voted to honour those commitments, I'm sure they'll be honoured. Ian Reid there, despite the way he sounds, he is actually Scottish. CEO of Pfizer being questioned by British MPs a little earlier today on the company's proposed takeover of AstraZeneca. Raffaello, when we were listening to that, you were muttering under your breath, this is just grandstanding by MPs. But surely this
I'm
is exactly...
cynical about these committees,
surely this
I'm afraid.
Is what MPs should be doing. They're asking tough questions about a company that in fact has even admitted today, yes, is going to cut jobs in this country.
Yes, but I mean, I think my comment is more based on these sorts of parliamentary committees and having seen a lot of them and having participated in some of them. And it's very funny that the ones where there's a lot of media attention, an awful lot of them actually show up to. And a lot of the ones that really matter, you see one or two MPs actually show up to. So my comment was more direct in that sort of light. I think, yes, there's, of course, it is the duty of government and parliament to sort of question these sorts of big deals that are going to have substantial implications to the national economy. The issue I have a bit with this is I'm quite a free marketeer at the end of the day. And I believe I'm not so sure that government really has a role in sort of becoming involved and meddling in these sorts of deals. Well, you see, I can see the debate when you're talking about something like national defense or something which really impacts the national interest in some way. With this, I don't know. I mean, this feels like a more sort of commercial company in some ways.
These are jobs in this country, and the politicians, the elected officials of this country want these jobs to stay. Surely they have a right to say, well, you know what? Okay, you could get rid of all the jobs and you might make more of a profit, but is that right for our nation?
Well, it's true, but then the question becomes how much are you going down the path of protectionism and just sort of protecting companies and making sure that they don't sort of collapse, and then you end up with companies that aren't necessarily market competitive. They sort of lose that sort of edge. You do need to have some sort of competitive forces that force companies to go in direction to do things. Now, I don't know. This particular deal, we've seen Pfizer has, I think, tried to do this before, and there's a lot of skepticism about what exactly they're planning on doing, if in fact it's about Pfizer basically trying to rehouse itself as a tax entity in the United Kingdom to benefit from from laws here. And I you know, I don't know exactly which direction that's going to go in.
Jeffrey Kaufman, I want to bring you in here. And and you mentioned Amazon before, and the fact that they seem to be based in Luxembourg when they're selling books to people in Britain. Starbucks as well seems to be selling coffee not from Britain but from Monaco or who knows where.
Not
if you look at their books. Is this becoming more of an issue, do you think, this idea of companies moving from one country to another because they get a better tax rate?
Sure, of course it is. But and I think what's interesting about this is that if you read the American press, this is a different story than it is here in the UK. I mean, here in the UK, people are talking about how the American company Kraft took over Cadbury in 2009-10. I think they took it over on February 2nd, 2010, saying, we will not cut any jobs. 7 days later, they closed a plant and laid off 400 people, and it's continued. And so there is a huge amount of skepticism. The UK rewrote its takeover laws in 2011, and is actually, it's harder for Pfizer to do the what Kraft did because of that. But in the US, you know, this is being seen in Congress as potentially a way for AstraZeneca to funnel its business. They're talking about moving their head office here to London, but keeping their executives in the U.S. And because corporate taxes are lower here now than in the U.S. And so the Americans are saying, in Congress are saying, wait a minute, are you guys just trying to avoid tax? Meanwhile, here in the U.K., they're saying, are you going to take all our jobs and move them all to the U.S.?
So basically, politicians everywhere, the elected representatives of the people are unhappy on every side.
It is a very confusing story.
Yes. We're going to have to move on just before the end. I want you to take a little listen to this as we head to France. Everyone in the studio is humming away there. But France's Justice Minister, Christine Taubira, was attending a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the end of slavery in the country earlier this week. And when the strains of Les Marseillaises began, she decided not to join in. Now, it is election time in France at the moment. And Marine Le Pen, amongst others, also the leader of the UMP, the centre-right party, were furious, absolutely furious, that someone would not sing the French national anthem, and they've called for her resignation. Raffaella Pantucci, this is nonsense, isn't it?
Yes, I think it frankly is. I think this is the Front National seeing a perfect opportunity to herald their sort of call for French values and France and, you know, vive tout ça. You know, it's just Marine Le Pen seeing a wonderful opportunity to grandstand. And frankly, it's probably something that resonates with a lot of her core audience who will look at this politician who is, I think, a minister who's born in Guyana, in French Guyana, but, you know, a French resident and national. But, you know, she does have that sense of being a foreign national who's somehow gotten her way into French politics. And look, she's not even singing the national anthem. This fits so beautifully to Marine Le Pen's themes that she can hit the socialists over the head with. She's been doing very well in the polls already. This gives another excellent opportunity just in the middle of election season. So, yeah, I think it's a completely silly story that's being blown out of proportion by the Front National.
And Jeffrey Kaufman, you know, as Raffaello says, Christine Taubira, she was born in French Guiana. She's obviously black, but she's also, as Justice Minister, she's been bringing through, she was responsible for the gay marriage bill.
She's been very progressive. And, you know, this is nothing less than racism towards her. She is a black Justice Minister. And let's be clear, François Hollande stood next to her at another event when a soloist played the Marseillaise and did not sing either. I mean, you know, as they both have said, you know, sometimes even when you know, an anthem that can be sung should be just listened to. And, you know, she said this was a solemn occasion to mark slavery. It was not for her a political statement or of any contempt for her nation. And this is just a symptom of all of this far-right anti-immigrant sensibility that is gripping so much of Europe. And as Raphael said, it's just a way to capitalize on it and to motivate a base that loves to get angry.
And yet we also, you know, we saw this in the US during the 2008 election. Barack Obama was accused of not wearing what you guys call a flag pin, what the rest of us will know as a flag, a badge.
But was he even born in America? Did we ever really see that document? Exactly. I don't remember.
The birther controversy. Yeah. What was exactly the same thing. The birther controversy, which is the reference to these politicians or these people, phantoms on the internet demanding to see whether he was really born in Hawaii or not, or was he really a Kenyan. It was just a code for racism in that case. And I think we're seeing it there. It is really disgusting, but it is effective if you're trying to motivate a base.
Mm-hmm. We will leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Raffaello Pantucci, as ever, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to be in Bogota, hearing from our correspondent there. We'll also speak to one of the rising stars in European crime fiction. And before the end of the programme... the latest music releases from New Zealand, of all places. There might even be a world exclusive tucked away in there too. But before we get started on that, here is Suzanne Chislett with the world news headlines.
Thank you, Steve. An explosion and fire in a coal mine in western Turkey has killed as many as 20 people. More than 200 are believed to still be trapped 2 kilometres below ground in Soma, 120 kilometres northeast of Izmir. Nigeria's government says a window of negotiation is open with Boko Haram rebels who abducted more than 200 schoolgirls a month ago. A special committee has been set up to consider any demands. Ukraine's prime minister has urged Russia not to use natural gas as a new type of weapon against his country. Arseniy Yatsenyuk also accused Moscow of seizing tens of billions of dollars worth of its assets and energy resources in Crimea. A top European court has ruled that internet companies can be made to remove irrelevant or excessive personal information from search engine results. The Court of Justice of the European Union has upheld a complaint from a Spanish man over his right to be forgotten by Google. It says it's disappointed with the ruling. And Paris and London continue to vie for the title of the world's top tourist destination. Official figures show 16.6 million people visited the home of the Eiffel Tower and the Louvre last year, while 16.8 million toured the British capital. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And many of them can be found at Baker Street Station, just around the corner from us, particularly on a Saturday when they're all trying to go to Madame Tussauds. Why go to Madame Tussauds? I mean, really, there are so many great places to go here in London. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. As ever, at this time of the day, we like to check in with one of our correspondents from around the world. And today it is Anastasia Maloney, our correspondent in Bogota. I spoke to her just before we came on air. Let us start with the upcoming election. Colombia goes to the polls on the 25th of May. President Juan Manuel Santos is running for re-election. And although he is the favourite, it's been a slightly underwhelming campaign so far, hasn't it? With a number of allegations going back and forth between the main campaigns.
That's right, yes. I mean, in fact, the La Semana, which is Colombia's leading weekly magazine, its headline is "No More Dirty War, the Country Wants Proposals, Not Insults." So there's been lots of accusations being fired by all the opposition candidates at each other. And last week, alleged hacker was arrested by police. Apparently he'd been working for the opposition candidate, Zuluaga, who's standing against Santos in the election. He's been accused of hacking into personal emails of the current president, Santos, and also spying on peace negotiators in Havana. So there's been lots of allegations of spying and bribery, and generally Colombians feel they're hearing more insults between the candidates than actual proposals, particularly what candidates are going to do to improve education and healthcare in the country.
Well, indeed. I mean, we'll come on to the peace process in a moment and talk about FARC and its history and its current position. But despite the fact that President Santos had hoped to be able to focus on those peace talks, as you say, issues like education and health are actually proving to be far more serious for most voters.
That's right. In fact, peace talks are the top five issues don't appear. Colombians are more worried about jobs and unemployment, and that's despite unemployment rates actually going down in Colombia. It's around about 9% unemployment rate. When Santos started his four-year term, it was around 12, 13%. Colombians don't feel that improvement. For most Colombians, they are worried about jobs, the economy, and that is also growing. So I think part of the problem that Santos is facing is it hasn't been able to communicate his message properly, that in fact, during his four-year term, unemployment has gone down and the economy has been growing. But Colombians don't feel that to be the case. As you say, education and healthcare still remain top issues among Colombians, and the peace process is quite weighed down on their concerns.
In the long term, though, the peace process is certainly what people outside of Colombia will be looking at most closely. And those talks are happening still in Havana. They've been rumbling on for some time now, a year and a half. And FARC is also coming up to another interesting date. They turn 50 on the 27th of May. There's unlikely to be a cake with candles. Has FARC worked out yet what it wants to be once these peace talks are over?
Yes, well, this is the big question, and it depends on really who you ask. I think it's fair to say that the FARC are at the negotiating table because they do believe that they have a chance to convert what people are saying, their weapons, into votes. They've always wanted to become a political party. In fact, they have been in the past, but most of their members were killed by right-wing paramilitary groups. But they want to try and become a political party to win votes and take power that way, rather through a military struggle. However, opponents of the peace process would say that, in fact, the FARC have no intention of giving up the armed struggle and the fight against the government. So it's a controversial question, really. What do the FARC want? No one really knows, but you would assume that they are trying to hash out a peace deal because they've been in talks, as you say, for many, many months now.
Now, after the elections, everyone's attention will move elsewhere if they haven't moved there already, and that's to the World Cup, which takes place in Brazil, of course, in just under a month. And Colombia is one of five South American teams that will be playing in the World Cup. And until recently, you'd hope you were going to do rather well, hadn't you?
Yes, Colombia hasn't qualified for the past 16 years in a World Cup. So this World Cup for Colombians is really important, particularly because it is in the Americas, in South America, and its neighbor, Brazil. But Colombia really thought they had their A-team, their best possible team, with Falcao, who's a fantastic striker who plays for Monaco. But he's been injured for the past 3 months, a knee injury, and he's been out of action. And Colombians, the big question is Falcao going to be ready in 30 days' time to play in Brazil? And people are saying that without him, without their best striker, it's going to be difficult to get those goals.
Now, is this one of those stories that everyone suddenly becomes a medical expert? I remember in Britain when David Beckham broke his metatarsal, I think in 2002, just ahead of the World Cup there. Suddenly everyone, first of all, knew how to spell metatarsal, but his foot was on the front page of the papers for days on end as we all agonised over whether he was actually going to be fit. Is that same obsession taking place in Colombia right now?
Oh, yes, without a doubt. They're absolutely obsessed with the recovery, day-to-day recovery of Falcao. And in fact, it's caused a bit of a tension with other members in the national team, because there are others who have been injured as well, and they're saying, you know, why don't we get that attention and those headlines, because we can actually score goals as well. So there has been a bit of tension, but generally the feeling is Colombians are backing their team with or without Falcao. They're really excited about this World Cup, and commentators and all the anchors, the sports anchors, the experts are behind the team 100%. And the national team is actually being coached by an Argentinian coach, and he's very good at managing the press and having a sort of a positive atmosphere around this team with or without Falcao. He's saying that it's possible to score goals, and we can't just depend on one man in our team, and that we're going to do really well. So he's keeping up the hype and the enthusiasm around Colombia's performance.
That was Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's very own Bogota correspondent, speaking to me a little earlier. Anastasia mentioned their football commentators and how big they are in Colombia. You can read more about that in the new issue of Monocle, which is out later this week, which includes a whole World Cup series, including a little thing on football commentators, including one from Colombia. Up next, we speak to one of the most talked about young novelists in Europe. Stay tuned. You're listening to Midori House.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Joël Dicker has taken the Francophone world by storm with his novel La Vérité sur l'affaire Harry Quimper. And he's also taken the Anglophone world by, well, approaching a storm with the English version, The Truth About the Harry Quimper Affair. It's a story starred on American Noir. A young girl, Nola, disappears in a small New Hampshire town and the subsequent hunt to find her. But it's proved a huge page-turner across Europe. It's been translated into 32 languages. It's been launched here in the UK now, and its debut is expected in the US before the end of the month. And the man himself, Joël Dicker, joins us live on the line now from Geneva. Joël, thank you very much for joining us. The spiel we got from your publicist described you as the biggest Swiss export since Roger Federer. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we now need to, all the publishers around the world, we really need to make our proofs because, like, there's a big pressure with such a big name. But anyways, I'm very, very excited about the release of the book in English just like a week ago. And I'm very pleased because it seems that it's starting very well. So we'll see.
It certainly seems to be going very well here. Now, you're often in the interviews and reports I've read about you described as a lawyer, and this has been your first big success. Despite the fact you're in your late 20s, this is in no way your first novel, is it?
No, absolutely. It's my sixth book. So basically, when I started to study law in Geneva, I was quite bored at school, and so I decided to use this time to write a novel. And I tried once. Was my first novel. I was like 20. And I sent the manuscript to many publishing houses, and everybody refused it. So I tried again, and I wrote a second novel, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth. And finally, the fifth novel gets published after 2.5 years of fighting to find a publisher. And a year after came The Truth About Harry Quimper's Affair. So it is my first novel in English. It is my second published novel, but it's my sixth novel.
When you look back to those early novels that you wrote, do you think that the publishers were just wrong to ignore you, or do you look back at them now and think, yeah, you know what, actually they were good training grounds for me, but they weren't actually they shouldn't be published?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first of all, I was 20 when I wrote my first novel, and of course when you're 20 or when you're 29, there's a big gap because there's a lot of things that happen in your life. The thing is, I guess it's two different ways. I'm very aware that the fact that all the other novels get refused, it helped me to try to improve my writing, to help me to work harder on my plot, on my stories. But probably if the first one immediately gets released in France, I would have, I don't know, followed another path in the way I worked on my writing skills. So I guess it's, for me today, it's a kind of a blessing because I've built the novel. I've built my sixth novel on all the work that I've made on the fifth before.
We had Ben Fountain in here a few months ago, who's an American author who wrote Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk, which is an astonishing novel about Iraq. And he has despite the fact he's in his 50s, he has a very similar background to yourself in that he trained as a lawyer and wrote several novels before he actually found his success with this one. Do you feel that, as you say, you know, you said you find practicing law a little boring at times. Do you find that actually to have that sort of very focused work during the day on law, on things that might be a little bit boring, allows you to then be a bit more creative when you have your free time?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, studying law was a choice because I always been very interested in writing, playing music, but I was also very keen to study, to work, and I was very interested in law. When I started studying law, I very quickly realized that it was not really what I was into. But in the end, it was a very good frame for my life because I had this life very, you know, as law is, there's rules, it's very right. It's the way you have to do it. There's one way to do it. And then there's the world of fiction. And I remember that one of my professor battled with me a lot because he wanted me to follow very strict rules to answer the question in the exam. And I was asking for more freedom, more creation in the exam. And he was like, no, there is no room for creation in law. And so it's a very good point that you just mentioned because for me, being able to write a fiction, it was a very, very important part of freedom that I needed in my life.
Gilles Dicker, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on the line from Geneva. Apologies for the quality of the line there. Gilles Dicker, author of The Truth About the Harry Kibbeh Affair. I'm sure it must be out in your country by now. I mean, it's out everywhere else. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
We're going to have a bit of a music review from New Zealand in a moment, but to take us there, this is definitely not from New Zealand. It's Licky Lee with Gunshot. Gunshot there by Licky Lee. More music now because it's time for our arts review. And today we're talking music in New Zealand. A short while ago, the music journalist Christopher Tubbs spoke to Alad John, and he began by bringing us a world exclusive.
Let's look at a favourite of mine, a band from New Zealand. They do get a lot of airplay in the UK, but I'm not sure how much traction they've got outside of Europe, perhaps. But Fat Freddy's Drop are a very, very good band, to say the least. This is a remix by Team Dynamite that you want to talk about. Let's have a listen to Bones before we get started. Heat it up, babe. Heat it up, babe. Heat it up, babe. Things There by Fat Freddy's Drop, the remix by Team Dynamite. Christopher, why is this track an interesting one for you?
Well, Fat Freddy's are very old friends of mine, and I have a music production past. When I made my debut album in 2001, they all played on my album. I was very, very lucky. It was before they were big. And I bumped into these guys last week, and they just had this out of the oven, and I thought it sounded perfect. It reminded me very much of early DJ Fitchy and Dallas tracks. That was the incarnation before Fat Freddy's Drop actually formed. I'm just such a huge fan of what they do. I think they're the best live, one of the best live acts in the world.
Having seen them live myself, yeah, I have to agree, they were terrific. It was some years ago, but something that I mentioned before we listened to the song there, do you see that they are getting more traction sort of internationally now?
Mainly through their live tours, I think. You know, I think their music manifests best live, although they are, in their own right, I think, quite immersive experiences. And, you know, if you follow their progress through their three albums, you know, it's very, very clear what their musical progression has been and where what they've been listening to at the time. Recent addition to their sound has been, of course, like the incorporation of Detroit techno, which I think is fascinating considering where they came from, which is predominantly, you know, soul, reggae and dub.
Good stuff. Okay, let's move on to your second choice. This is Brood's track, Never Gonna Change. What's special about this? This is the Lone remix.
Well, these guys, keeping on a Kiwi tip, these guys are an Auckland duo. And here they're remixed by a Nottingham producer. His name's Matt Cutler. And he sort of came to prominence in about 2007. He was very much of that kind of abstract post-Jay Dilla instrumental hip-hop ilk, if you know what I mean. When he started, he kind of showed a musicality that was sort of far ahead of his UK peers at the time. And in about 2010, he started moving into more dance floor productions. He really brought a kind of modern sheen to classic sort of New York, New Jersey house sound, very musical, but with a more kind of crackly modern production take. You know, all the synths bristle with this kind of electric energy, and I just really love what he does. And I think this is a really good example of his sound.
Okay, deep house, crackly, electric. Let's have a listen to it. Chris is making me dance by myself in the studio. I'm really liking it. It's a strange experience.
I don't know if that's great. A good image or a disturbing image. I'm not sure.
Luckily, there's no webcam at Monocle 24. That is the Lone remix of George and Caleb Knott, otherwise known as Brood, Never Gonna Change. Moving on, the last one, Chris, what have we got?
Now, this is completely unrelated to the other two tracks. This is just something I have searched for so many years. It's a bit of a holy grail of kind of disco 12s for me. It came out in Epic Records in 1976, and it's called Do It With Style. It only ever came out in promo, and I have been hunting for a mint copy of this record for about 5 years. And in the spirit of, you know, sharing great music with like-minded listeners, or, you know, I hope, I just thought that I had to put it out there because I am currently going through, you know when you get a record that you love and you just can't stop playing it again and again. Well, I tell you, that 12-inch is not going to be mint for long because it's on day and night, and I just wanted to share it.
Okay, good stuff for sharing, and we're going to have a listen now. This is Webster Lewis, Do It With Style. an incredibly rare disco 12-inch there. That's Webster Lewis with Do It With Style. Christopher, just quickly before we go, tell me why that's special to you. Tell me about Webster if you can.
Yeah, he was born in Maryland, and I think in the mid-40s, and he's one of these guys that came up predominantly as a session musician. He's a, you know, very proficient jazz keyboardist, and found himself with a record deal on Epic Records in the mid-70s, and had, you know, a little bit of success. That record is special to me because I heard DJ Harvey play it on a particularly epic night out one night, and it just stayed with me for weeks afterwards. And what makes it so special is it's got a double hook. Just when you think the chorus has arrived, it by no means has. It's just a bridge. And then when the chorus finally hits, it drops into this sort of minor chord, lush kind of crescendo, and just totally takes your head off. And if it sounds good on the radio, you wouldn't believe how good it sounds on a dance floor.
Christopher Tubbs there speaking to Alad John, and that ends today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Raffaello Pantucci and Jeffrey Kaufman. Midori House was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alex May. The studio manager was Alex Funnell. Of course, later on today, you've got the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. It's 1800 hours London time. For now, my name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.